More of Lake Effect now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. If you're an American, the chances are good that you know little, if anything, about the eastern Russian city of Magadan. But if you are a Russian of a certain age, you would think of it as a remote place where dissidents were sent to live under Stalin. To writer Ksenia Melnik, it's also known as the place where she grew up, and a place of contradictions, many of which she deals with in a new collection of short stories called Snow in May. Melnik immigrated to the United States as a teenager and now lives in Texas, where she joins us via Skype. Welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to start by mentioning that one of the first things I did after starting to read this book was to hop on the internet to read more about Magadan. This is not a place that most American readers will have much, if any, familiarity with.
No, but I think, you know, if you lived in Anchorage, Alaska, which is where we moved from Magadan in 1998, you would have heard of it because in the 90s, there was actually a lot of communications starting between Magadan and Anchorage. But yes, other than there, yeah, it's not very familiar.
What was the Magadan of your childhood like?
So I was born in 83, and that's like the tail end of the Soviet era. And it was great for me. I had such a happy childhood. I remember going to the kindergarten and school and the music school and choirs and sports activities. It was, I mean, really, it was kind of an idyllic childhood. It's beautiful there, the northern austere beauty. You know, it snows, so a lot of people just did a lot of skating and skiing. In the 90s, however, when I was a teenager and I started to understand a little more about just what was happening around me, that's when the Soviet Union collapsed and sort of the infrastructure collapsed. And there was an exodus of people from Magadan to the continent, which is what people there call the rest of Russia, kind of like, you know, the lower 48 for
right.
Alaskans, the continent, just because Magadan is so remote and so isolated. And a lot of people struggled. You know, a lot of people weren't getting paid, or they would be getting coupons to grocery stores. A lot of people were very, very nervous as to how to survive as the country was sort of transitioning to this new economic system. But I was lucky because my father actually already started working in Alaska. So he was able to help us out, you know, send money and even send food with pilots on the flights from Anchorage. So I was just thinking back, how did others survive?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Well, in fact, there's a character in one of these stories who spends some time, who basically is one of the first people to start work in Alaska. And I'm wondering if of all of the characters and situations in any of these stories that are directly drawn from people you knew or things you experienced, is that an especially strong one for you?
I believe you're talking about Closed Fracture.
Yes, I think so.
That's the Tolik.
Yes. Yeah.
So some of the broad outlines in that story are, you know, are based on some of my family history. My dad, who grew up in Magadan, was able to tell me how it was, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, and then how it was in the 90s. So I was able to check some of my own research against his stories, his own immigration story that was very interesting.
When you were growing up there, how much did you know about the city's kind of dark past?
I'm glad you asked that because actually I didn't know anything. I'm still pretty shocked about that. So there were some monuments in town. For example, there's this monument called a memorial called the Mask of Sorrow that was dedicated to the Gulag prisoners who were exiled or perished there. But I didn't really concretely understand what that meant. You know, I might have even been conflating that with like a memorial for World War II, you know. I don't remember studying it in school. You know, the country was still transitioning to glasnost and to, you know, how much are we going to talk about the past? And maybe that wasn't emphasized, or maybe people just kind of wanted to move on with their lives, you know, and then necessarily dwell on this dark history. I don't know why. Maybe I was just too young. So really, most of this I started studying and understanding when I moved to America and when I started writing, and specifically when I started writing about some stories that were set in Magadan.
Well, it strikes me that, you know, the first question I asked, most Americans don't know practically anything about Magadan. You yourself were in a position where you were also learning about this place that you were from.
Yes, as a child, as a young person, an older generation definitely knows Magadan. Well, it has kind of a double connotation, because on one hand, people know of it as this, you know, port, this administrative center of a pretty vast network of forced labor camps. But on the other hand, in the 60s and 70s, the time of my father's youth, when the Gulag era was over and they needed people to come there and continue to develop the north, that area is pretty rich in natural resources and gold and timber and, you know, all sorts of stuff. There was actually a lot of subsidies for young specialists to come to move there. So it was a coveted spot after you graduated from university. People used to make like two and sometimes three times as much money there as, you know, in the European part of Russia. So on one hand, it has this dark history. And on the other hand, later on, it was kind of like this cultural center and a pretty thriving place by the time I was born.
Right. I have a note written to myself that it feels, as you portray it through these stories, like kind of a cultural outpost.
Mm-hmm. Yes, partly because of these new young people who came in the 60s and 70s, and partly because some of the prisoners were of the Soviet elites. You know, a lot of artists and actors and musicians and writers and just highly educated people who stayed, either because they just couldn't go back to their lives. You know, they lost, you know, their families maybe didn't survive the war, didn't survive the repressions, or because they now wanted to build a new life in Magadan, or because they couldn't, oftentimes, even after people were released from their official sentences, their civil rights were taken away and they were actually not allowed to move out of that specific area. So they had to stay, you know, and then after they stayed for 5, 10, 20 years, they just stayed on. So it was this artificially created cultural center in a way that was just in the middle of nowhere, you know.
Was it at all hard to come to terms with that kind of new understanding of this place that you had spent at least your early childhood?
I mean, I was very shocked. I was surprised that I didn't know. But I think as a writer, I was, not that I was excited per se, but it just opened up because I already had this kind of emotional cachet of my childhood memories. I had this fuel in a way to write fiction. And then when I started to learn about all the historical aspects of the town, I decided I'm not going to set my stories in just some random, cold, isolated Russian town. I'm actually going to set them in Magadan because I can do some research and I can try to kind of paint a portrait of this very specific, very unusual, unique place that I have this connection to.
What did writing short stories offer you in painting this picture that writing a single novel would not have?
You know, I don't know. Probably, I think many, many beginning writers start with short stories. And I felt like I had just so many stories to tell that I wasn't sure if I'd be able to fit them all or connect them all into a single novel. There were just so many different voices.
Sure.
It started pretty naturally as I was learning to write, and it just started with short stories.
Aside from place, what did you see as the common threads that you wanted to explore through these stories?
I have several stories that kind of trace the lives of women, and I wanted to imagine in as much of a nuanced way as I possibly could, like, what did it feel to be a young woman, say, in these different decades. For example, I have a story, Strawberry Lipstick, right, that's in the late 1950s. And there's a young woman there who marries a military officer. So what does it mean for her to have a good and happy life within the economic and political constraints, you know, at that time, sort of the war just ended and the country just climbing out of this destruction and hunger, and the Stalin just died and there's some new freedom. But, you know, what can a young woman do independently? How can she advance and build her life? And then we have Tanya in Love Italian Style, or In Line for Bananas, right, which a young working mother is on a shopping trip in Moscow in 1975. And, you know, she's trying to provide for her family, and just shopping was a science and an art. And there were just all sorts of different tricks that people did to get certain things, and then how happy they felt when they did get them. And then that also parallels with the mail order bride in Alaska in the late 1990s in Kruchina. So all of these women are just trying to figure out how, basically, what is a good life, you know, how to live it within these historical constraints. And on a different note, I think almost in each of my stories, people are either traveling or migrating or immigrating or moving somewhere. And that is also obviously because of my own story that I moved. I think you just get such a different perspective on your life after you make a big move. And in the same way as, I don't know, if I stayed in Russia, I probably wouldn't be writing these stories. You know, I just, to me, I see Russia in a different way from the distance of miles and years. And so do my characters. They see their lives in a different way after they move somewhere, after they travel somewhere, in a different light. And I have that theme of moving and migration in the book. And that's also, of course, set against the kind of shadow of the bigger population migrations that happened in Russia in the 20th century, like the population relocation, like the Chechens, you know, in the 1940s. And of course, the huge swaths of society that were uprooted and exiled as Gulag prisoners. So that's just another theme of how life will change once you move.
Has this book made its way back to Magadan yet? Have you heard from people who are still there?
No, I haven't heard from anyone. I mean, it hasn't been translated into Russian. I know some people know that it exists, but I don't think they've read it yet. So I would be, you know, I would be curious to see what they say.
You don't have any book signings planned there
in Magadan? I actually have not been back there since we moved. Mm. So since 98.
You live in El Paso, Texas today. And I wonder if there is any place in the world that is less like Magadan than El Paso, Texas.
No, there isn't. I don't know. Maybe Afghanistan. I don't know. But I live in the desert now. I mean, El Paso is right on the Mexican border. And in fact, I see Mexico from my living room, which is very interesting. And in a way, I really love it. I mean, in a way, it's similar to that Magadan Anchorage connection, just the interaction of the two cultures. It's a very interesting place.
Well, and at the same time, when you go out for a run and it's 100 degrees,
mm-hmm.
It must be a little surreal to think where you have come from to be in a position where you're going out for a run and it's 100 degrees.
It definitely is, but I like challenging myself. It's the same now that I have. So I've lived in Alaska and I've lived in New York, both the upstate New York and New York City. And then I came back to Alaska, and then I spent a little time in Oklahoma, and now I'm in Texas. And for me, it's almost that the place comes alive fictionally once I leave it. So now that I'm not in Alaska anymore, and now I'm not in New York anymore, I can look back from my Texan perspective and think of, oh, what kind of stories can I tell about those places now that they kind of bundled up in this have a certain memory about them, a certain time frame that is not my life anymore.
How did you happen to end up in El Paso?
Oh, well, my husband is a captain in the army, and he's stationed here at the moment. Yeah, so I've been kind of forced out of my comfort zone, forced to explore this part of the country that I didn't think I would naturally just, you know, travel to or settle in.
But in a way, I wonder if being having a writer's eye towards this sort of thing makes it kind of it makes it an interesting challenge.
Oh, of course. I mean, for writers, ideally, nothing is lost on us, right? I mean, any travel, any calamity, any personal, even tragedy, you can always file that into, oh, maybe I can use it someday, or it just writing helps you process it in a certain way. So any travel is good for writer, I believe.
Well, Ksenia Melnick, we will look forward to the books about Alaska and New York and Oklahoma and Texas.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ksenia Melnick's collection of short stories is called Snow in May. It is her literary debut. Melnick grew up in Magadan, Russia, and later Anchorage, Alaska. She now lives in El Paso, Texas, and that's where she joined us from via Skype. That's all for Wednesday's edition of Lake Effect. Don't forget the interactive web component of our Project Milwaukee series and the high rate of black male incarceration in the Milwaukee area is now live. You can learn more at the website morethanmyrecord.tumblr.com. I'm Mitch Tyke. So great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're your NPR station in Milwaukee. Coming up at noon, it's Here and Now on WUWM, but stay tuned. Coming up next, it's Fresh Air. The time is 11 o'clock.